did you first get into the business of jazz festivals?
Jazz festivals, it's so long ago. Gosh, the first one was 1954. We're going to have our 30th summer of jazz festivals next year. I was a musician. I am a musician still. But I opened up my own club in Boston. It's called Storyville in 1950. And we used to get a lot of people from all over New England. It was a different kind of club for those days. It was it wasn't a joint. It wasn't like a jazz joint. We sort of like to think of ourselves as a jazz theater, even in those days. And we got a lot of people from Boston University, from Harvard, from different schools adopted the club. One night, a professor from Boston University came into the club with some people from Newport, Rhode Island, the Lorillards, Louis and Elaine Lorillard, and they had been doing something with classical music in Newport, Rhode Island. And so Professor Don Bourne said, well, why don't you do something with George Wein with jazz in Newport? So they asked me if I had any ideas, and I went home and I came up with the idea of the Newport Jazz Festival. And that's how it started.
What did you choose to have a country setting for it, away from the urban centers where jazz usually flourishes?
Well, as I say, I didn't choose that. I was asked to come there, but at the same time, when I accepted it, I knew my public in New England because I had had my club for 4 years, and I knew I knew practically every jazz fan by name, by first name, and I knew that they would travel to do a unique concert. And so we put together two wonderful days. One of the things in that first concert was, for instance, a reunion of Lester Young and Billie Holiday, the first time they had worked together in ages. And that was a very poignant moment when Lester walked on the stage with Billie Holiday. And so that was the type of thing we put together even that first year. And it just caught the imagination. And the most interesting thing was the second day it rained. And 5,000 people sat in the rain, and the wire services picked up the photos of the people sitting in the rain with umbrellas and raincoats over their heads. And I think that focused more attention on the first festival than anything that could have made it, that could have happened. The fact that it rained was a plus, because the next year it just took off.
So then you were able to get increasingly ambitious with what you were able to do at the festival. Did you have an idea of the kinds of things you wanted to do at Newport that you felt weren't being done before?
Well, remember, times were different then. Jazz was not, you know, an accepted word. Jazz was basically, there were no critics on newspapers writing about jazz. There were no jazz radio shows except maybe a Symphony Sid in New York at 2 o'clock in the morning. That was it. We weren't accepted by the establishment in any way. And my concern was, in all honesty, was, you know, I wanted to make the profession that I was in a respected profession. And I worked towards that all my life. And so we worked in trying to get the news. We were responsible for the New York Times having a jazz critic, John Wilson. I was given that job there because they'd sent Harold Schoenberg to cover a jazz concert, and Harold Schoenberg said Errol Garner was not a jazz piano player, and there was such a hue and cry that the concert was our Newport Jazz Festival. And there was such a hue and cry about it that the Times said, hey, we better have a permanent jazz writer. Well, that sort of cracked the ice in a lot of things. And then slowly but surely, jazz became a good word instead of a bad word. It went through many, many difficult times, including riots and everything else, but that we survived.
What were the other barriers, and what are still some of the barriers in achieving that respectability or acceptance in mainstream culture of jazz?
The barriers are different now. The barriers are on a much higher level. We cannot get the people that fund the arts in America, the rich people in America, the upper 0.1% that support the arts, if it's even that high, you know, a number of people, to accept jazz as an art form. They will not. They will give to the opera. They'll give to museums. They will give to ballet. They'll give to symphony. But if you say, why don't you give 10% of what you give to the arts to jazz, they would think we're crazy. First of all, we haven't set up the machinery to accept the money and ought to get the money, you know, not only accept it, but to even know how to go about applying for it or asking for it. So the most we've ever received, I say we, the world of jazz has ever received in that kind of support, has been from the National Endowment or the state councils. Now, of course, with the COOL programs, we've started the first time corporations, Brown & Williams Corporation is really making a major investment in jazz. And that might be the beginning of something, of breaking down these barriers. We should have jazz repertory companies. We should have jazz organizations in major cities, just like we have symphony, ballet, and so forth in every major city in America.
Have you tried to get into the psychology of why people with money will fund the ballet and opera and avoid jazz?
It's very simple. It's tradition. Tradition is the greatest asset to something and the greatest difficulty to overcome. The traditions of families, of the wealthy families in America, go back to they built the opera houses. They built these symphony halls. They built the museums. So their children, their grandchildren, their great-grandchildren, it's part of the tradition of the family to contribute to those things. The state, the idea of the state supporting the arts is very, very recent in American history. So that's the answer to that.
Well, let's get back to the Newport Festival. What have been some of the musical highlights before it became the COOL Jazz Festival? Let's talk about the 50s and the 60s. What are some of the musical highlights that stand out in your mind from Newport?
Well, there are so many, and it's funny. People ask me this question many, many times, and we've done so many festivals over the years. I think I have over 200 years of festivals that I've worked on right now. And, of course, the Newport Festival was in Newport for 17 years before it left. And all these things sort of merge into each other. It comes a great melange of wonderful moments. People ask me years, ask me times. I can't remember what year something happened except in rare instances. Of course, the great Ellington performance that was recorded, that we remember because it was recorded, although we would have remembered it even if it wasn't recorded. But that was when Paul Gonzalez took 27 choruses, and I think it was Reminiscing in Tempo or something to that, whatever it was, the name of the tune. But that was it was just one of the great, great moments that we've ever experienced. But there are so many moments that I can remember. I can remember Miles Davis when he didn't have a group, when I put together this all-star group. I think Monk was on piano and Jerry Mulligan and baritone and Miles on trumpet. And they didn't have none of those people had groups at that time because business was so bad for jazz. And that's when Miles put his microphone, his trumpet right into the microphone and played Round Midnight at the festival. I think it was the second festival. And just took off from there. You know, that was everybody wrote about Miles Davis. He was the star of the festival. We had a terrible sound system that year, but he came through that system with that beautiful sound. And that was a great moment. And we could go on and on about that.
In the late 60s, many rock festivals were formed, the biggest and most famous of which, of course, was Woodstock. Did that whole approach to rock festivals and the expectations that people came with to rock festivals change the nature of Newport at all?
I think it changed the nature of all festivals. There's no question. We learned a lot from the world of rock. We learned what to do and what not to do. And we learned that, you know, we used to wire down 19,000 chairs on a field and number each chair outdoors. Now, we found that was totally unnecessary. Now, the festival we do in Newport, Rhode Island, we don't even have chairs. The kids come in blankets and sit there, and they enjoy it much better. We set up booths. We have food booths. We have crafts booths. This is something that we learned before the rock world. We learned that from Newport Folk Festival, when we used to have our afternoon workshops. And so we learned from a lot of areas, but it really caused us, it put us to the wall, the rock generation. What it did was it tried our fiber, our moral fiber, the strength of our music. Because at that time, the press, the media, everything, jazz was finished. All the newspapers were appointing rock critics who are still writing. They're reviewing. There was this hunger in the world of rock, and which was, of course, helped by the tremendous money that the record companies poured into the newspapers and advertising to be accepted as an art form. Now, rock is popular music. I mean, we can call it a culture, whatever you want. It is a culture. Everything's a culture. But there was this desire to be accepted like jazz, and in order to do this, they had to override jazz. So you'd read where Ginger Baker was a drummer like Elvin Jones. You know, you'd read these things. And you'd get confused yourself because people were writing these things, and I was a producer, and I say, hey, I'm going to be contemporary. I've got to figure out what's happening. And so I would start bringing in the Mothers of Invention to my festival. I would start bringing in the Blood, Sweat, and Tears. And these people maybe have that musical value, but they're not jazz. And they really relate very slightly to jazz. And so I nearly destroyed my festival by doing that. But somehow or other, I made the mistake once, and that was it. I never did it again. And we survived. When the press was saying, hey, there's nothing happening in Newport, you're just playing the same old thing. I said, the same old thing is the greatest music we have in this country. And somehow or other, it continued. And we always had our public. When jazz was really, you know, like people over 30, jazz was over 30. You know, it was just being, it was being put away. And but it couldn't be put away. And that was what the rock generation, what the rock era of the Woodstock era did to us. It made us realize, and I keep saying us, I'm talking about the world of jazz, and which is my world and the world of so many great people, that that they just had to keep the faith. And those, the ones that did, have survived. And the ones that did really are doing better than they've ever done in their lives right now.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Who are some of the people who thought they wouldn't make it and are now doing quite well again?
Well, whoever, Dizzy Gillespie, I mean, Max Roach, Art Blakey, I'm talking from that era, from the earlier era, Teddy Wilson is doing better with work and financial than he ever did in his life. Teddy Wilson's in his 70s. As long as they're healthy, as long as they've built up their reputation, as long as they play the way they've always played, they are doing better than they've ever done.
I think it was in 1971 that there were some disturbances at Newport. What happened?
There were disturbances twice. First in 1960, and that we won't get into it too much because there's never been a riot at the festival per se or in the festival grounds. Everything always happened outside the festival because so much attention was focused on Newport, Rhode Island at that time that the people would come into town who really didn't care about the music. And in 60, there were people that came in because the town broke their own liquor laws and left the bars open till 3, 4 o'clock in the morning when they usually closed at 12 o'clock or 1 o'clock. And we had a riot that year in the town of Newport. That was a riot, but not in the festival. The police asked us to keep the concert going till after 2 o'clock so they could clear up what was happening in the street. But yet there was riot at Newport Jazz Festival. It took us years to overcome that stigma. Then in 1971... That was the year after, 2 years after Woodstock, a year after the Powder Ridge incident when up in Connecticut when there'd been a ripoff. They announced the festival and the city fathers canceled it, you know. So there were thousands of kids. The underground press in those days, which was such a big thing, which has since disappeared, was saying, there are no rock festivals this summer. No authorities will allow them, you know, no towns will allow them. But there is the Newport Jazz Festival, which isn't rock, but there are a few good sounds up there. They got Aretha Franklin, they got Ray Charles, and a few things like that. And you can sit on the hillside outside the park, and the fuzz won't bother you. I mean, this type of talk. Thousands of kids descended on Newport. And we had a packed house, and they came in on a Thursday. The police sent them to the hillside. It was a disgrace. And they started telling the police they're going to be on the stage at 10 o'clock Saturday night, and they started breaking the fence down on a Saturday, and we had to ask 20,000 people just to file out. They filed out without incident. Kids got to the stage, the festival was canceled, and that's when we left and had to come to New York. It was a sociological happening, you know, part of the times.
Was part of the reason the idea that music should be free?
That was part of the philosophy. Music should be free. But it was also why, there was more than that. Why could jazz be allowed to have a festival when rock couldn't be allowed to have? It was part of a rebellion against a society that wouldn't allow rock to have its festivals.
Did that cause you to go home and introspect a lot about what kind of festivals you should be providing and what kind of security you should be providing?
No, it didn't do that. It caused me to look back at 17 years of my life and say, where am I going from here? And I immediately knew that security and all those things meant nothing. Guns and that you couldn't keep people out. We had all the security there. We could have destroyed those kids. But I know I gave instructions and I said, let them do it. If that's what they want, if they want to destroy us, we have to be destroyed because we can't fight back. there is no way. We can't club people in the head. We can't throw tear gas. We can't, because we'll destroy ourselves that way. I would rather be destroyed the other way. I would rather be martyred than be the cause of hurting people. And so that's exactly what happened. That I immediately knew that we had to do something. I don't know why. Maybe it's just my own inner thinking that causes me to do things. You never know why you do things, because I should have been finished at that time. And I had no money. I was in debt. I mean, it was a serious point in my life. And I just made up my mind that I had to continue the festival. And it had to be in an urban area, because the concept of resort and suburban festivals was finished for the time. Because you can't police people. People have to police themselves. People have to discipline themselves. You can't say, this is what you're going to do. If they can do anything. Crowd can do whatever it wants. But I said, if we do it in a city, at least it's tougher to tear down Carnegie Hall than it is to tear down a little fence in Newport, Rhode Island. And it was not fashionable to tear down Carnegie Hall, you see. So I went to New York, and I rented Carnegie Hall. I did things that weren't supposed to be done. You couldn't do them. I rented Carnegie Hall and Avery Fisher Hall for 10 days each at the same time. That time it wasn't Avery, it was just Lincoln Center. And we changed the whole structure of summer entertainment in New York at that time, because Carnegie Hall and Avery Fisher Hall used to close July 1st. And so I rented the last week and the first couple of days of July, and they stayed open for us, and we were an immediate success. Why were we a success? Because the media adopted us. We were the martyrs. The media were all people my age. I was in my 40s then. They were all people, the city editors. They said, why can't we save this festival? This is our era. This is something that we grew up with. Does it have to be destroyed just because some kids broke fence down in Newport, Rhode Island? And that's how we started in New York, and that's what saved us. This tremendous outpouring. It was an emotional outpouring. No public relations could get what we got. It was a happening. And that's what saved the Newport Festival and did a tremendous amount towards saving jazz itself. I don't think that is the jazz is strong enough. It doesn't need the Newport Festival. The cool festivals doesn't need anything. But all those things help, and they're very necessary to that type of growth of the art form. But look, the only reason we can help is because the art form is there and the musicians are there. They'll always be playing the music.
Let me just reintroduce you for our listeners just joining us. George Wein is my guest, and he's been the organizer of the Newport Jazz and Folk Festivals, now of the Cool Jazz Festival. So when you moved to New York, did a lot of people tell you you were crazy? You said you'd done things that people had never done, like running Carnegie and Avery Fisher Halls for 10 days apiece. Did people tell you were nuts and that you'd lose your shirt?
I don't think they had the courage to tell me I was nuts, because it wasn't even involved. I mean, It was, you weren't crazy to do something that nobody ever thought of doing that couldn't be done. You know? And I spoke I was asked to speak at a meeting of the Concert Hall Managers of America, and the only other speaker that day was Sol Hurok, and I'd never met Hurok. And this was about a month before our event, and that's really the reason I was asked to speak, was because everybody was so excited about this thing. And I said to Mr. Yorick, I said, Mr. Yorick, you're aware of what we're doing? He says, yes. He says, I am. I says, tell me, do we have a chance? And he says, you just might. You just might have a chance. And thank God we had the chance, and it worked.
In the mention of Yorick's name reminds me, I was wondering what word you like to use to describe what it is you do. Do you like the word impresario? Organizer? What word do you
impresario
like?
Impresario is what I write on my, and I have to put in occupation, but impresario in America is one thing. Impresario in Europe is another thing. An impresario in Europe is a manager, you know, an artist manager, an artist representative, or an agent. In America, it means more like an entrepreneur, you know, and I don't know. I mean, I was given an award recently by the Alumni Association of Boston University, which is my college, for distinction to the profession. It was a very nice award, and it was a nice dinner up there, and I was very proud to receive the award. But everybody was speaking. The president of the college was there, and I heard people talking, because different people were giving for contributions to the community, and, you know, different awards. And mine was the one award for distinction to the profession. And I said, I I never write a speech. I just talk off the top of my head, and sometimes it happens and sometimes it doesn't. I said, as I sit and listen to everybody speak about the awards they're receiving, and I'm receiving the award for the distinction to the profession, it makes me wonder, and I'm sure you're wondering too, what is my profession? Because, in effect, I'm really the only one in the world that exclusively does what I do. Now, other people produce festivals, but they don't do that only. In other words, usually jazz festival producers are people who have other things, and then they also, like Jimmy Lyons at Monterey or different people around the world. Well, I'm the only one that does festivals on an international basis. And so it started off in a nice way. So people ask me what I call myself. I don't know, but I guess jazz festival producer. I don't know.
When you moved to New York, there was a series of loft concerts that got started at the same time as the Newport Festival, a kind of competitive thing, and part of the concept was that Newport hadn't incorporated enough of the avant-garde of the contemporary jazz scene, so that these counter concerts got organized mostly in the Soho area in the lofts there. How did you react to that? Did you see that as a threat or a challenge? What did you think of those concerts?
Oh, I think that's a stimulus. That always happens. It will probably happen in Philadelphia here by people will say, well, we're not on a festival. We're going to start our own festival. And that's great because that started back in the 50s when we had the Rebel Festival at Newport when people like Mingus and Ornette Coleman started a little thing back in the 50s. So we're very used to all that, and we think it's great. And it stimulates things. It creates controversy in the newspapers. It helps the media write about things. And look, we're the strength. We have become the so-called jazz establishment. We have a responsibility to the whole world of jazz. And that's one of the ways that our responsibility can be used, by creating things that we don't have the wherewithal to create. And it's great. I love it.
Oh, so you feel good about the
alternative concerts. My gosh, it's the greatest thing that could happen because now a lot of those people, the people that were in the original Rebel festivals, if they're still alive, are the stars of the festivals now, you know, that we have. And a lot of the people that used to play on the Loft festivals are now on our festivals now. So it's necessary.
How do you like to balance the billing between the big attraction performers and the lesser known performers, the more avant-garde performers?
That is the most difficult thing we have, because I have a fetish. I don't like to put on concerts that nobody comes to. I'm not talking about money or making money. To me, you could put on a great concert. If nobody comes to it, why did we do it? I mean, so I don't mind, and I don't like to do free concerts because free concerts, in a sense, demean the artist. I don't mind them, but the artists don't want to play on free concerts. They feel, well, man, I want to be in the concert hall, I want to get paid, and I want people to pay to see me. So I feel that people should pay something for a concert, even if it's only $1 or $2 or $3, which was the whole spirit behind our New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival. Now, so we have always tried to utilize the bigger names in jazz, in a sense, to subsidize the lesser names in jazz. It's been sort of a continual rotating wheel.
George Wien is my guest, the organizer of the Newport Jazz and Folk Festivals, now the Cool Jazz Festival.
We no longer organize the Newport Jazz Festival. We are exclusively Cool Jazz Festivals and several others that we do.
Right, I'm sorry, I thought I said was.
Okay. The creator of it. Right. That's for my sponsor, I have to say that. And but I'm very grateful to these people.
Well, let's get into that. How did you get organized with the Cool Jazz Festival? With Cool, I should say. How did you hook up with Cool?
It's an interesting thing how that happened, because we never solicited Cool. We had a festival in Cincinnati called the Ohio Valley Jazz Festival. It started as a pure jazz festival. And it was always a hit-and-run situation of whether we made it or we didn't. We never made money, but we never lost that much money that we had to quit. So we kept trying each year, and out there we experiment with certain commercial people like Dionne Warwick, Ike and Tina Turner, and slowly but surely this festival became a soul festival, and we started doing incredible business. But we never changed the name jazz, because it started a jazz festival, but the people in Cincinnati, they were going to the jazz festival, even though each year it got less and less jazz. And I had to do a lot of explaining, a lot of apologizing. Well, you call them the jazz festival, there's no jazz. I said, well, that's too bad, but the people in Ohio and Cincinnati are going to the jazz festival, and they don't want to change it, so I'm not going to change it. Well, some people from Cool came down. Cool is in Louisville, Kentucky, and it's only a couple of hours from Cincinnati. And we had a very large black audience, probably 90-95% black, as this festival developed. And so Kuhl thought it would be good to relate to this. Some of the kids used to, from Kuhl, some of the people used to go down to the festival, and they went back and they said Kuhl should get involved with this festival. So we got a letter from them one day, and the next thing you knew, we were in business with the Kuhl jazz festivals. And we went on a major program of these different soul festivals around the country. And last year, Kuhl decided, or 2 years ago, they decided to come into the New York Festival. And last year, they made an arrangement with me to drop the Newport name and change the name to Kuhl. Now, this was a major move because nobody knew how the New York press or the media would accept the change from this hallowed name that had been built up for over 20 years. Let's face it, we'd been honored by Jimmy Carter a couple of years ago for the 25th anniversary of the festival. So the media accepted it without any question, you know. And so Kuhl was ecstatic about this, because I was ecstatic, because it meant a lot. And it was a very dangerous move, because if they didn't accept it, we would have been hurt very deeply. And so that gave Kuhl then realized that maybe it was better to, if they wanted to attach themselves to a musical thing, to do it on a much purer basis and get involved on the artistic level of jazz and not just the big commercial level of soul music, even though soul music will reach many more people than jazz will. In the long run, jazz has a more lasting relationship. And they made a major policy decision, and God bless them. I mean, it'll be one of the best things that has ever happened for jazz music, the involvement, because they have given, when I say they've given me total freedom to the programs I produce, they never get involved with the artistic end at all.
You were initially worried about how the press and the audiences would accept it. Were you concerned that the health hazards associated with cigarettes would damage the reputation of the festival?
I never get involved with that because my job is to produce the festivals, and that's something that is a corporate problem. And so if people ask me that, I just tell them to call Kuhl and get their attitude on it.
You are now running a festival that operates with corporate support, whereas many festivals smaller festivals have tried to operate with, say, state arts or National Arts Council funding. How have you found the corporate support of the arts relationship to work for you?
Oh, I think it's just fantastic. There's much less. See, when a corporation puts its faith in you, it's not a political situation. The state support and the endowment support becomes political. They have to be fair in how they give out the money. And then they have certain requirements that have to be honored. We started the New York Jazz Repertory Company, and I got a $60,000 grant from the state council, which was a big grant at that time. But they made me spend $20,000 or $30,000 of that grant on establishing an organization because I wanted to contribute my people to run it, you know. No, that wasn't right. You couldn't do it. That was conflict of interest. And so it dissipated half the money that could have been spent on concerts and the musicians because we were going to volunteer our people to run the event. And so that's a problem. That's a really serious problem for a lot of organizations because they'll go to apply for money and they'll say, well, where's your office and do you have a full-time administrative head? Do you have this? Do you have that? And jazz organizations don't have that yet. They're not equipped for that. So there's a lot to be done yet as far as public support of the it's one thing when the National Endowment gives the Metropolitan Opera $3 million, whatever it is they get. Fine. They have an organization that meets all the requirements. But a little neighborhood jazz situation in Philadelphia, how do they do that? There's no way they can do it. So the best thing that the endowments have done is give some personal grants to individuals who are writing, and they'll give $10,000 grants sometimes, and $2,000 grants. That's a very good part of the program. But the fact that they're giving is really the most important thing. And if it's cut out by this new thing, it's going to be that money is irreplaceable. There's no other place to get that money.
I'm sure you've spoken about this issue with a lot of other impresarios. Do you think that other people also feel, you say you've had a very good relationship with Kuhl and there's been really no pressure on you in terms of how to book, that you're free to do the programs that you wish. Do you find that other people in similar positions to the one you're in have had also a lot of freedom?
That I don't know, because I think that's up to the person. If you make your deal, you have to establish the ground rules before you make your deal. There's always somebody in a corporation that say, hey, man, well, I'd love to have so-and-so in a festival. And you have to say, well, I think that's great, but he doesn't fit. Or else she's going to say, oh, well, if you want him, we'll get him for you. I mean, that's up to the individual. He has to assert himself.
So you have a very happy working relationship. Now, what do you think of President Reagan's policies of cutting back on federal funding and for the arts, suggesting that the private sector will pick up that funding?
You know, I think it's like this. I think that we live in a world, in a dream world someplace, saying if big corporations make more money, they're going to expand and maybe hire more people. But the average middle-class man, if he makes more money or saves taxes, is not going to go out and spend that money and hire somebody he doesn't need. And so I think that filter-down thing is only a halfway measure, and I think that's involved with the arts too. If corporations make money and they can get a tax deduction and some publicity for the arts, maybe they'll give some. But they're not going to make any dedication to the arts. That's not their business. The business of corporations is to sell their product. And so I think it's faulty thinking. I think that we have to cultivate, one, the government supporting things, but more than that, we have to cultivate the people in this country who contribute to the arts to contribute to jazz and to all the arts. It has to be a personal thing. It'll be great if corporations do it. And I think there will be more and more of it happening. I think the success of the COOL program will generate a lot more of that because people will see the publicity, which will be 99.44% favorable to what COOL is doing. And I think that will generate a tremendous help. I don't think it's the total answer. And I think there is a reaction against corporate support by some of the people in the arts because corporations want something in return and they have a right to have it. That's promotion. And if the promotion is in good taste and it's done well, why not give it to them?
I've noticed the huge advertising campaign that COOL has embarked on tying in with jazz, and there's jazz musicians on most of their ads now, and there's billboards and large magazine ads. It's impossible to miss, really. Do you care to comment on that?
I'll comment on it totally to this extent. I like to think that the success of New York and the association with COOL in New York last year and the Festival of New York was responsible for COOL making that major change in the image of the brand. Maybe it was and maybe not. I won't say any more than that.
Okay. What effects do you hope this network of jazz concerts will have on the state of jazz in America?
I think it will stimulate in each town a lot of interest in the music. I think you'll find clubs opening because they'll say, hey, if jazz is popular, why don't we play more jazz? I think it will stimulate media interest in jazz, which, of course, stimulates business. Media is very important in this country, and media is learning more and more to accept its sense of responsibility towards communities, and they are much quicker now to support events in a city than they used to be. You don't have to prove yourself. If they feel that you're going to contribute to the community, they will support it because they know it helps the community, and that's what will happen with jazz. They will help jazz more.
How healthy do you think jazz is now? Where would you put it?
Well, jazz is probably healthier than it's ever been as far as the public's concerned. How healthy it is musically, I don't know. Because we have been, many, many influences are happening. And what is happening that bothers me is with all the experimentation, with all the concern with fusion jazz, with avant-garde jazz, there is a tendency to lose the precious quality that jazz had. I'm not talking about style or anything, but a simple 4-4 beat and swing was the essence of the music. And fewer people are playing that way. And when that is lost, and if that disappears completely, which I don't think it ever will, then we are into a different thing. I mean, that is the precious thing of jazz, swing. It's the only music of its kind. And replacing the swing with a funk beat or with a rock beat is not helping the music. Maybe there are some interesting things that can happen from that. But I think there has to be a concern. I'm not saying we have to play like Duke Ellington or play like Count Basie or play in that structure because time moves and style comes in. But bebop swung, and that was totally different from the swing era. And Coltrane swung, and that was different from bebop. We can't lose the concept of swing. And if we do, we're in serious trouble in jazz.
So what do you listen to now?
Well, that's the jazz. I've been involved with jazz so much. People ask me what my favorite things are. I have no favorites. I get involved with artistry. That's what I have to appreciate now, because style means nothing to me. You know, I've learned to recognize, I hope, what is artistry within the musician playing. And so it could be anything at any given time. But I also listen to a lot of opera, you know, because you just, your own tastes are very personal. And one of the sad things about jazz is when you know, there's a lot of jazz on radio now, more than ever. And NPR plays a lot of jazz. But so many of the records being played by on jazz are by musicians that have died. But that's good and that's bad. It's like playing Beethoven, so to speak. He's dead. He's dead for several hundred years. But it would be nice if there were more Coleman Hawkinses around and more Lester Youngs and more people that were not concerned with selling records but concerned with playing good music. Because a lot of jazz musicians get recording contracts only because the record companies say, I think I have an idea that'll sell some records. You know, well, that's good, but that's not the motivation, the real motivation of a jazz musician. The real motivation of a jazz musician is to play as good as he can and hope somebody likes it and will buy the record.
Since you've done so much work in America and in Europe, could you compare for us the nature of the interest in jazz in European countries and in America and the support that it gets?
One thing we have in Europe that we don't have in America is civic support of the arts. We do a big festival in Nice, and Nice gives a large subsidy because they want that festival in the community. And most of the city festivals in Europe have civic support from City Hall. That's unheard of in America. And although I understand it may be happening in Philadelphia here, you're doing a city festival, so let's hope that's the beginning of something. You know, was it the Century Four or something like that? And it's supported by the city, hopefully. So that's one difference. The other difference, I think, is that America, I think, is a much greater jazz audience than Europe. This is something people don't say very often. Because in Europe, we try to develop basically jazz as a young people's music in Europe. And older people don't go to jazz concerts. Older people, the people are more, there is much more of a generation gap in Europe than there is in America, put it that way. Much more. And we've noticed that for many years. And so I'll try to get my people who produce concerts in Europe to reach a broader segment of the community. They don't know how to do it. They only have their outlets through the jazz areas. And our whole life is spent getting out of the jazz areas and reaching a much broader segment of the community. And it works in America. So any jazz concert you come to, unless it's a youth-oriented one, in most cases will have an average age of 35 to 40 with kids from 16 to 60 in the audience. It doesn't happen so much in Europe. It does at our festival in Nice because we spent years cultivating it as a family event. And bring you half price for children and come and bring your kids and it's a picnic style thing. We had to work very hard to do that. I think the audience in America is much more sophisticated as far as jazz is concerned. At one time, the audience in Europe was better because after the war, they had tremendous respect for American artists as artists, and Americans had not learned to do that. Jazz musicians were still entertainers. And that was immediately after the war when Louis Armstrong was an international idol and Duke Ellington. They went to Europe when they were lionized. And here they were just entertainers. That's changed. And I think that the American audience is much greater than the European audiences.
Well, one final thing I'd like to ask you. Jazz has gone through different periods of integration and segregation. How integrated do you think jazz is now, both for audiences and for the musicians who perform it?
You mean integrated in the sense of race?
Racially integrated, yeah. And I mean on stage and off.
I think that jazz has always been a forerunner of integration, going back to Benny Goodman, Lionel Hampton, Teddy Wilson. I think amongst musicians, other than envies and jealousies, it's not racial. There are naturally some people have racial feelings. But that, I think it's a very superficial racial thing. I think there's jealousy or envy of somebody making a lot of money. I know a lot of white musicians who are very sad because they feel nobody accepts them because they're not black. And I know black musicians that feel that nobody accepts them because they're not white. So this goes back and forth. But you get the guys in the stand, if they play together, I mean, you know, I mean, Miles Davis has two white kids in the band, and you'll find it makes no difference. Basie has white kids in the band, most of your white leaders have black kids in the band. I mean, that's the way it goes. And I think the great equalizer is the music.